Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here once again. W-R-E-N, The Wren, and Sunday morning wake-up call, getting together on a Sunday morning. We also have with us Dr. David Germano. He's the executive director at the Contemplative Sciences Center, as well as being a professor of Buddhist studies. Good morning, Professor.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on your show today.
Well, it's that goes both ways. Thank you for being with us. I invited you because I see mention of the Contemplative Sciences Center all around the university. But although I'm a UVA grad, the center wasn't there when I was there, and I haven't learned much about it since I've graduated and continue to live in Charlottesville. But all the online magazines have mention of it and things that you're doing. So I want to learn more. So I'd like you to tell us more. How did the Contemplative Sciences Center come about?
Well, it originally came about from 2011 to 2012, where basically a couple of the major donors at the University of Virginia, Paul and Sonia Jones, contacted the UVA president then, Teresa Sullivan, to ask whether the university might be interested in doing something in relationship to yoga, contemplation, and so forth. And so Teresa, President Sullivan, took that question and brought it to a group of faculty, of which I was one, and it spurred a kind of year-long conversation across the university about what we might do, given an opportunity from philanthropic sources, to address these kinds of issues to do with contemplation in higher education. And so out of those conversations and a lot of back and forth with the donors, Paul and Sonia Jones, was born the Contemplative Science Center. So 2011, 2012, took about a year-long process with a lot of different stakeholders at the university involved in the conversations.
Now, it just seems that for a university that is so based on, I'll use the phrase, Western academics, I don't know if that's even a proper phrase, that this seems so similar to Eastern studies. Am I right?
Well, that's not really how I think about it. In fact, contemplation is a term that Thomas Jefferson used in his own time, you know, several hundred years ago. It's a term all of us use in our kind of daily parlance. It's a very common term, unlike a word like yoga or even meditation. Contemplation is something that I think we're all familiar with. And so part of the process to go from the roots of the center back in 2012 to where we are today, which is kind of evolved considerably in terms of scale and mission and so forth, has been thinking about this word and concept and practice of contemplation and trying to think about what it really means with regards to education. So if we think about the term contemplation and just how we use it in our ordinary conversation, it's a broad variety of contexts. You might say, I'm going to go contemplate and do a retreat, and I'm going to do some intensive week-long thing or something. But you also might use it just in the sense of an employee comes to you and says, you know, are you going to fire me? And you might say, I'm going to contemplate it, you know? So we use the word contemplation in such a variety of ways. But when we think about it, I think the common element is that contemplation means there's a pause or a gap between a stimulus and a response, between a situation and how we act in response to that situation. We leave a gap, we leave a pause. Now that pause may be like 5 seconds. It might be the deep breath that your grandmother or grandfather urged you to take when you were confronted with a difficult situation before you responded to it, a provocation. It might be a 4-year gap, a gap that we give many of our youth between high school and the need to get out there and involve themselves in a chosen profession. So a pause or a gap. And in that pause or gap, contemplation kind of calls attention to what do you do with that time? What do you do with that interval when you have the luxury to kind of take stock of a situation or ponder a subject deeply and widely? And so that's what we think of in terms of reflection. And we think of contemplation as having a very strong relationship to reflection, that in that gap, we reflect on things. We reflect on history. We reflect on ourselves. We reflect on relationships. And we also think contemplation relates to kind of quiet and calm in some intrinsic way, that our lives these days are so filled with noise. There's so many distractions. There's very little space where we can just decompress, and we have this kind of quiet in which our minds can creatively and unconsciously unpack things. And so that's also associated with contemplation. And the last couple of things I would say is that it's about intentionality. It's about being deliberate, being conscious, about being self-aware, not just living out certain practices that you engage in, or having values that you haven't really understood, or dispositions that you haven't really considered, but kind of consciously doing an inventory on who you are, what you're doing, what your life is about, what you care about, what's important to you, and thinking about, how might I change these things? How might I be more intentional about the practices I do and the way they embody my values or the way they're productive of my well-being? And so to summarize all of that, the way we've kind of evolved thinking about contemplation that is really pertinent to every human culture on the planet Earth is that these are about practices of flourishing. They're about intentionally, deliberately working with your mind and your body and your relationships and your attention and so forth to try to realize your deepest potentials, your goals in life, and actualize well-being for yourself and others. And so when you think about it in that way, I think the case could be made that contemplation is really at the heart of what education should be, an education that educates the whole person, their mind, their bodies, their emotions, their relationships, in subject matters, for professional outcomes, a kind of deeply integrated model of education. So in that sense, yeah, it's there in Asia, but it's also there in the West, and it's there in religions, and it's there in secular society.
Again, we are talking with Dr. David Germano, professor of Buddhist studies, executive director at the Contemplative Sciences Center. Dr. Germano, so you mentioned the word flourishing. That seems to be a key part of the Contemplative Sciences Center. By the way, for our listeners, you can read so much more about what's going on, and we'll get through as much of it as we can today, as many projects and initiatives, et cetera, at csc.virginia.edu. But the word flourishing is mentioned so many times. Human flourishing for education, work, and life seems to be one of the goals or missions of the center. Is there a different way, a different method that's used for flourishing in terms of education versus the career versus life?
Well, the reason that we've really grown over the last decade to go from contemplation to a central focus on flourishing is that contemplation is really more of a means to an end. Now, you might say, I want to leave a contemplative lifestyle, and it's not only a kind of means to an end, but really we're asking kind of larger questions, which is, what are we trying to achieve with our lives as individuals and as communities? And how does education, elementary school education through higher education, how does it relate to those goals? And so we've settled on the kind of term flourishing rather than well-being, because I think flourishing is a term that on the one hand is more comprehensive than well-being. You know, we often think like, I don't have time to be well. I have to study hard for this class, or I have to work really hard on my professional outcome or this relationship, whatever. But when we think about flourishing, it's really looking at the entire individual, and it's asking this question, what does it mean for what do you value in this life? And what are the deepest potentials you want to actualize? What does it mean for you to be profoundly well, not just in your, you know, in your body, in your emotions, in your mind, in your job, in your home, in your community, and so forth? And flourishing also is a very dynamic term. Sometimes we can think of well-being as kind of like a plateau or kind of equilibrium that we aspire to. But flourishing really for me speaks to the dynamic nature of life and deep states of well-being, that we have to be constantly adapting and being resilient in the face of the manifold changes we're constantly encountering. So flourishing, that's what we've kind of come to as the central mission of the center, to think about how does education relate to flourishing and what does it mean to flourish? Are there different models of flourishing for different cultures and different constituencies or different walks of life or different stages of life, like your question asked about? And in that context, flourishing kind of goes hand in hand with the absence of flourishing, whether we think of that as languishing, which is one prominent model by Corey Keyes at Emory. He talks about kind of two continua model of well-being, of mental well-being. One is of disease, where you have the presence of disease to the absence of disease. And he says the absence of disease is not health. It's not flourishing. It's not well-being. And so his second continua goes from languishing to flourishing. You can have no disease, but you can be languishing. And you can be flourishing, and yet suddenly, like we see in the pandemic, you can have a disease, or you can have a mental illness, or a physical illness, or social problems, and so forth. So our thinking about flourishing and what flourishing means goes hand in hand with an analysis of how are our young people doing. I mean, I to answer your question directly, because now I'm getting distracted into the larger mission of the universe, of the center. I think that flourishing is something that has a kind of unitary cast to it, but the way it manifests and the practices we need to engage in to flourish, whether we're a one-year-old child or a five-year-old kid in elementary school or a high school kid or an undergraduate or someone who's in their 30s or 40s out in the world, is going to change in character. But I don't think the kind of fundamental model of how we think it means to flourish as individuals and communities, I think that's something that we're constantly exploring over the course of a lifetime, but I don't think it necessarily segments into this is flourishing when I'm 10, and this is a totally different model of flourishing when I'm 20, and then 40 and 50 and so on.
So you mentioned unitary, because there's also the mention about complete balance for success. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of models of well-being and increasingly a lot of models of flourishing that are out there. You could argue that these models are implicit in every culture, but a lot of people are theorizing it these days, particularly in the social sciences, but also in the humanities. And one of the things that concerns me about some models of flourishing is they just focus purely on, let's say, emotional balance or something, or they're looking at kind of mental well-being or health. And I think when we're looking at an integrated model of flourishing that treats the whole person, whether it's for a student or for an adult beyond education, we have to look at the body. We have to incorporate the body. We have to talk about healthy eating, drinking, exercise, sleep, also bodily awareness. How well do you understand your body? How well are you in touch with your body? How well can you register various kinds of knowledge and understanding that your body's picking up, but maybe not being registered by your cognitive mind explicitly? And so the body is interwoven with all these other aspects. If your body is well, then it's a support for a well emotional life. It's a support for positive social connections and so forth. So the body is really crucial. But so is what you might call stability or security. If you don't have financial security, employment security, psychological security, physical security, if you don't live in a community as an individual that has a kind of equal access to others and so forth, then you're going to really struggle. Those are real external constraints to your potential for flourishing. And so we have to bring those into the equation as well. And then there's things like connection and wisdom and resiliency and so forth. So all of these things in my mind have to come together in a kind of integrated way, because they're all mutually supporting and mutually constitutive. Awareness. If you're not someone who has deep levels of awareness, self-awareness, awareness of others, awareness of your body, awareness of your emotions, it's going to be hard to find physical health. It's going to be hard to connect to others, where it relies upon you being able to have empathy and be aware of others and be aware of your own perspectives and other people's perspectives and so forth. At the same time, if you don't have wisdom, if you don't have the capacity to see patterns, for example, again, it's going to be hard to socially connect to people. It's going to be hard to perform in your chosen job and vocation, where I guess I'm not sure I answered your question well, but the last thing I would add to that is that I think most of the important skills in life apply to all parts of our life. So when we take a history course at the University of Virginia, for example, and there are certain things we have to learn, like pattern recognition, the ability to look at the historical record and see patterns, or we have to have the capacity to do perspective taking, to be able to take the perspective of individuals and people who might be quite unlike ourselves, or empathy and so on. But those kinds of skills are also directly pertinent to achievement and success in professional outcomes. If you don't have empathy, like in the business world, then you're going to have a challenge working in teams. You're going to have a challenge understanding your clients and the market and so forth. If you can't see patterns, it's going to be hard to do that as well. If you look in your personal life with your body or your social relationships, again, no empathy, no ability to understand another person's point of view, perspective taking, et cetera, or pattern recognition, being able to see that when I spend time with those people, it encourages this way of acting, which is positive for me or which is negative for me. So all these skills that are important in an academic intellectual context. They're important in a personal social context, and they're important in a professional, career context.
Well, Dr. Germano, I have to tell you that with all the things that you just listed, I understand their importance, but knowing that there's no way I would score an A on all of them, I'm feeling somewhat down on myself at the moment. How can I be the person that I want to be if I can't score well, if I don't have the complete balance of life that the Contemplative Sciences Center suggests that I should have?
Well, so one of the things we've tried to avoid with these kind of discussions of flourishing is putting out a completely normative model and saying, oh, here's what flourishing is. Because flourishing is relevant to who you are, to your background, to the culture you come from, the community you come from your own kind of values and so forth. And so it's really not about like what we say it means to flourish, but it's about let's look at our own lives. Let's look at what the research literature tells us and let's be reflective about these things. And everything is on a continuum. It's not like a binary. It's not like, oh, Rick is resilient or Rick is brittle. Rick is empathetic or Rick is completely dense to other people. Rick is self-aware or Rick is completely unself-aware. It's all a continuum. You know, you could think of it as 0 to 10, 0 to 100, but there's like infinite variations in between. And so it's not so much about saying, hey, I'm 100 on social connections, I'm 100 on healthy eating, etc. But it's rather to kind of be, persistently kind of taking stock of your life and thinking, what kinds of things am I doing with my life in terms of these various practices, verbal practices, social practices, cognitive practices, professional practices, and what are the outcomes they're generating and how do I feel about that? Is my life and my behavior aligned with the values that I care about? Am I well? Am I suffering? Am I happy? You know, are people around me feeling positive about their interactions with me? And if I see some problems or challenges, just working on it. So it's really more about thinking of our lives as journeys where we're constantly reflecting and engaging and trying to improve rather than switching from the non-flourishing to the flourishing.
Well, good. Now I feel much better. Again, our guest today is Dr. David Germano. He's the executive director at the Contemplative Sciences Center. He's also a professor of Buddhist studies. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Student Flourishing Initiative and a first-year course called The Art and Science of Human Flourishing. Hang tight. Be right back. And welcome back here, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, 97.9 The Wren. Glad to be back for another week here on 97.9 The Wren. Dr. David Germano with us, talking about the Contemplative Sciences Center. Dr. Germano, there's a course that I discovered, The Art and Science of Human Flourishing, taught to the first-year students. What's going on there?
Well, I'd like to give you a little background to that course and how we came about it. It's basically a collaboration between three universities, University of Wisconsin, a big neuroscience center there, and University of Penn State University, focused on kind of education, and then University of Virginia with our center. And the what this class is rooted in, I would say, is two things. The first thing is a sense that it is pretty apparent throughout the research literature, and I think pretty apparent to all of us who are parents, which is we are facing a historic degradation of well-being amongst our youth. When we look at the signs, stress levels, depression levels, anxiety, loneliness, isolation, suicide, suicidal ideation, etc., pharmaceutical abuse, what we're basically seeing is escalating movement in the wrong direction. Exponentially rising rates in all these categories. So what this tells us is if we compare the situation of our youth today to the youth of those of us who are older, it's really not the same. They're not as well as we were 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And so the question then for us in the educational context is, before we start thinking about interventions like this class, and this is what we did, we have to think about what's driving this crisis amongst well-being. What are the causal factors? Because that will begin to help us think about, well, how can we begin to address them in an educational environment? And the causal factors, according to the research literature and according to our own kind of perception, are manifold. One is clearly the environmental crisis. Whether you believe it or not, the research literature tells us a lot of kids, it's weighing on their minds that the world might be a place that is not a healthy environment to be living in, or actively hostile. The racial and socioeconomic inequity that we've seen all throughout this past year. Terrorism, school shooting, the sense that there's not physical safety in this world anymore. But in particular, the drivers that we see active are, number one, digital technology. And it's not just the distractions, the noise that digital technology has created. It's not just the social media and their judgmental kind of presence in our kids' lives, but it's also the way that big digital technology firms are essentially engaged in an unprecedented program to actively modify our kids' awareness, modify their attention, modify their behavior, and make them into reliable commodities that they can then trade on the markets and make a profit with absolutely no care whatsoever for our kids' well-being. And then finally, the nature of change, that change has fundamentally changed. It's more rapid in character, it's more complex in character, and it's more pervasive in scope, meaning that these kids are having to think about fundamental economic change, fundamental change in the climate, fundamental change in social interaction, et cetera. And it's basically outstripping their resources to be resilient. So when we think about this situation, then the question for us as institutions, like at Wisconsin and Penn State and Virginia, is, hey, this is not what life was like 20, 30 years ago. And so whatever we think about how well the higher education paradigm was working 20 or 30 years ago, we need innovation now, because these kids are not going in the right direction. They're not in a status quo. Their well-being is degrading. And so we need to rethink what we're doing in the academic classroom and other parts of educational life in order to respond to this, to give our kids the tools and the resources and the outlooks and the dispositions and the practices that will allow them to confront these challenges head on and hopefully find a resilient pathway towards their own flourishing and towards contributing to the flourishing of others. So with those kind of thoughts in mind, the three of us got together and we formed an interdisciplinary team from these three universities, people in religious sciences, philosophy, neuroscience, social science, social psychology, education, and so forth. And we thought, let's create an ideal class at the first year level for undergraduates. So as they're coming in, we can both talk to them about the art and science of flourishing. We can give them a kind of theoretical vocabulary to begin to think about these issues in their lives, in their communities, in their long-term kind of chosen profession and so forth. But also, not just that we're talking about the topic of flourishing, But let's re-examine how we do academic learning and ask the question, is what we're doing with large lecture courses and small seminars, is that really the kind of sum total of what the possibilities of learning are? Or can we take like large lecture environments and replace them with something different, something that's highly experiential, has peer-to-peer based learning, is helping them learn practices and developing skills and dispositions, and basically taking the theoretical learning of the class and connecting it up to their life in a very active, deep way. And so we started that 4 years ago. We've been teaching it every year since then and across the three universities. And we kind of collaboratively built this program together, which includes learning about flourishing from different cultural resources, different academic disciplines, but also learning how to connect that theory into the fabric of their personal lives as individuals, how to build relationships with other students in the class, how to learn different ways to listen to another student, how to talk and express yourself, and then also teaching them practices, small practices, little 1 minute practices, 10 minute practices that help them begin to think like if they're by their own self-assessment, they feel like, hey, I'm not as empathetic as I should be. I'm having problems with focus. I'd like to be more resilient. Okay, then what do I do? What do I do with my body, my emotions, my visualization, my awareness, my attentional practices that will help me more fully inhabit that? So the course intends to be an intellectual and a deeply personal journey through these questions of flourishing.
Again, our guest today, Dr. David Germano, professor of Buddhist studies and the executive director at UVA's Contemplative Sciences Center. Professor, is this course required, the first-year course, Art and Science of Human Flourishing?
It's not a required class. It's an optional class. It's still kind of being piloted. It's not the only class we teach. We're, like, for example, this January, the university is doing these special January term classes that are like, you know, we always have a January term. It's a 10-day, 2-week kind of intensive 3-credit academic class in 2 weeks for students who want to get an extra class in between the fall and spring breaks. And so this year, we're doing a special, what they call signature January terms. I think there's 12 or 13 classes that fit the category that are intended to be offered for students who, because of the pandemic, were unable to get a full slate of courses in. And so they're allowed, without paying extra tuition, to take one of these January term classes. And so a colleague of mine, Curtis Schaefer, and I are one of the 12 or 13 classes that are doing the signature J term. And our class is about Buddhist meditation and the secular modern world. Same model, a model that basically tries to connect theory with life, teaches practices, helps them develop skills, and so forth. But the Art and Science of Human Flourishing class, we've been piloting at 60 students, but this class is going to have probably about 700 students. And so it's a chance for us to experiment with, hey, can you take 700 students in a class and can you make it highly experiential, highly intimate, connecting theory to life and having people have peer-to-peer interaction? And so the experiment is a kind of direct outcome of this work we did with the Art and Science of Human Flourishing.
Now, the website said that the students taking this course were going to continue to be assessed from first year and beyond. Can you talk about that? People taking the course and a control group so you can learn from this.
Yeah, so we initially thought, because the nature of this collaboration was really focused on this course, and so we had the idea of making this really large longitudinal study, which hasn't happened. I mean, that work would be a very expensive project. And what happened instead was we decided, and I'm going to come back to what we're actually doing for assessment in a moment, but what we decided to do was to create a much larger initiative, which is currently an embryonic network called the Flourishing Academic Network, where we've invited other universities to join, Berkeley, Stanford, Colorado, Brown, Washington, and some others. And the idea behind that is to really not just focus on one class, but focus on a variety of courses, look at co-curricular, extracurricular, residential life, and so forth. With asking this question, what can we do to make this aspect of higher education more conducive to the flourishing of students, such as the application process, well known to be not contributive to the flourishing of most parents and children? How could it be different? You know, information technology, et cetera, et cetera. Now, to go back to the class, what we have been doing is we basically came up with a series of measures or instruments that are trying to look at these different issues of flourishing and to figure out whether the class has had an impact on them. So are students more self-aware, more mindful? Do they feel like they have better social connections? You know, are they more resilient and so forth? And so the three universities with researchers from each university, at our university, it was Karen Inquist from the School of Education at UVA, who's been the point person for this. We basically put these measures together from the research literature, things that are appropriate for what we're trying to do and have been validated in studies. And we gave these to the students in the beginning, in the middle, and in the kind of end to get a sense of how is the course impacted on these things so we can know whether or not what we're doing is having an effect. And then we also looked at issues of, we did some other things like classroom observation and some kind of pulling together a small group of students to talk about them and so forth. So a variety of kind of qualitative and quantitative measures. And then we also, with a select group of students, we also followed up after the class to kind of see whether the impact is sustained. And so that's still kind of a pilot nature of research, but the results have been quite encouraging. I think we have a publication that's coming out now that looks at some of the initial studies, and we're still, as three universities, collaborating on doing this over time. And what the results showed is that it does seem to be having an impact in these various areas that we targeted.
I just have this vision of the students reading Tao of Pooh, sitting there all talking about the characters throwing their sticks over the bridge and what that means. That's my vision of what's going on in the course.
Well, we didn't read the Tao of the Pooh, but I have read it in the past. It's not a bad way to think about it. I mean, basically the idea is they come to class having read things or listened to things like videotaped talks and so forth, and they've been exposed to some theory. Maybe it's, let's say each week is devoted to a topic. So one week is devoted to attention. Another one's devoted to compassion. Another is devoted to resilience and so forth. And so let's say we take the attention week, or let's say we take the emotional balance week. And so they come into the classroom meeting. We have two 50-minute classroom meetings with all 60 students. And what we're trying to do is create a series of exercises where the exercises are helping the students take the theory that they learned and connect it to the kind of fabric of their lives and the lives of their peers in the classroom. And so we go through these exercises. Like, for example, one exercise was talking about a theory called emotional granularity, which is basically the idea that you can take an emotion, like emotions are culturally specific. You know, different cultures construct them in different ways. And so you can take an emotion like anger, let's say, and you can come up with new terms to name very specific types of anger. And so where you had one emotion called anger, suddenly you can have 20 emotions, a very granular look at anger. And so like, one student came up with what he called wangry, which means anger upon waking up in the morning. Another one came up with pangry, the anger I feel when I'm having my period. So, you know, these are different. I joked around like the 50 shades of, anger from the popular novel and movie. So the idea is that we would go through these exercises where they would create these, and then they would talk amongst them with each other, and then we'd come back and talk about them as a group. So constantly going back and forth between theory, between exercises that help them connect the theory to their own life experience, hope, fears, disappointments, successes, and then learning about other people's experiences and then trying to bring that back to the theory and say, so does that theory make sense to us in our lives? And then at the end of the week, we would break up for a third meeting where it would be small groups of 20 students, and they would meet with a teaching assistant who would lead them through a series of practices where we would talk about these issues of emotions. Okay, how can we be better attuned to our emotions? And so we might do a mindfulness of emotions practice where we help them take identify a particular kind of attention, an attention that they can bring to bear upon their emotions, and without, you know, judging those emotions, just being open to their reality and seeing how they happen and beginning to better understand the life cycle of an emotion. And so when you feel pain, for example, or let's say you feel anger, let's not get into this and really, you know, elaborate it, but let's kind of ask the question, where did that begin in your body? Where in your body did you first feel anger? How did it progress from there? You know, and kind of split off one part of ourselves to bring a disciplined attention to that sensation of anger or joy or whatever the emotion might be. So that kind of gives you a sense of what the learning environment is like in the classroom.
Again, our guest today is Dr. David Germano from the Contemplative Sciences Center. Professor, we got about 2 minutes before our next break, but let me ask you quickly, you mentioned wangri for anger when waking up and pangri, anger when you have a period, which made me think about the different genders. Does flourishing happen differently for genders?
I mean, I think that there's so many different things that both divide us and unify us. So, you know, one issue is sex and gender, and other issues are, you know, race and ethnicity, culture, socioeconomic, you know, upbringing, et cetera. And so all of these things influence who we are and the kind of way we arrive in the world and our hopes and aspirations. And so what we try to do in the class is create an environment where we respect other people's experiences, which are different from our own, and hear those in a way that helps them articulate their experience and their values, but also look for patterns of communality, places where let's respect the difference. We do not have to be the same. Women and men don't have to be the same, or other sexes, other genders. We don't have to be the same in terms of religions or cultures, but we can still acknowledge our difference and we can look for places of communality. And so I think that the class tries to embrace the wisdom of what I call the wisdom of sameness, but also the wisdom of difference.
All right. Let's take a break. We'll be right back with Professor of Buddhist Studies, Dr. David Germano from the Contemplative Sciences Center. And we're back talking about the Contemplative Sciences Center at the University of Virginia. Dr. Germano, one of the things that brought this show to my attention was a program that I read about online. It's kind of wordy, so I may have the wrong title. The Citizen Leaders and Sports Ethics Community Impact Fellowship. Is that the right name for this project?
Probably. It is a long term, so I fear that that I also may not remember it completely accurately.
So to me, we'll shorten it a little bit for the listeners. It's the UVA scholarship athletes working with the Contemplative Sciences Center. Can you explain what goes on?
Sure. This is really the intersection of two things. One is a larger program that we're focused on, which we think of as student ambassadors for flourishing. And the idea behind that program is we would like to invest in student leadership. We'd like to get students to come to us and say, look, for my community of students, however that's defined, here's ways that we think we could find pathways to increased flourishing, and we'd like your support. And then we'd like to provide financial and staffing support to help make that happen. And so that's the bigger kind of project. The other part of this is the athletics department. We have an extraordinary athletics department at the University of Virginia. And I don't mean that we won the national championship in basketball. What I'm really talking about is the way in which our athletics program is so values-based. We have some extraordinary coaches, the well-known ones with Tony in basketball and Bronco in football, but also other coaches in lacrosse and wrestling and so forth. And what's really remarkable about this, and it goes right from the top of Carla, our athletics director, and her staff, is the way that they've consistently focused on educating these young people as whole individuals and expressing the importance of values in the work that they do in their life and the work they do in their kind of athletic community. So for us, we've really built a strong relationship with athletics because we think we have such consonant missions. And also I think that athletics is a really important place to look because they embody certain skills and practices that we need to bring more into the mainstream of education in universities. Performance, being resilient in the face of stress, using digital technology as a way to kind of track your body and mind and try to optimize it, the importance of teamwork and collaboration and so forth. So these are really important things, and we would like to help integrate those back into the mainstream of the university. So we came up with a pilot program because we wanted to create a pilot program that would launch this Student Ambassadors for Flourishing, and then we could scale it up later as we raise more money and so forth. And so the pilot program, as you mentioned, is the Citizen Leaders in Sports Ethic Community Impact Fellowship. And the idea of this is we put out a call for student athletes to get them to come up with suggestions as to ways that they could see pathways to create greater flourishing for their communities amongst other student athletes. And so we had three different student athletes that were chosen, and Leslie Hubbard, who's from our center and is the person who manages our student programs, she's been working with them. And the idea is over the course of the year to provide support and help for them to actually implement these programs on the ground.
Yeah, so let's tell the listeners what they are. I made notes of them. So you have someone from the cross-country team whose goal or challenge was mental strength in an endurance sport. And the plan was regular posts with positive tips on and off the field. You had a softball player to have the athletes connect and work toward a bigger purpose or goal. And the plan was to join a national organization that works with college athletics to provide children with chronic or life-threatening illness a support system to create an event. And then you had a volleyball player looking for team chemistry after ongoing team injuries, and the plan became an internet platform that helped learn more about one another on and off the court to help build this team chemistry.
And I should say, I said three, but I that was a mistake. It's four. And I could also connect this back to the Art and Science Human Flourishing class, because from the moment we piloted the Art and Science Human Flourishing class, athletics has taken an intense interest in the class. And a large percentage of our students in that class actually are student athletes. And so this pilot program also was a natural evolution that came out of projects that these student athletes were working on for the course itself. So that's a connection to the earlier part of our conversation.
Yeah, I found this one sentence to be so telling about this project in itself with the athletes and the Contemplative Sciences Center, which is mental challenges of exercise are sometimes greater than the physical ones.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful quote. And that is another example of how athletics has a lot to teach back to the mainstream of the academy, is that, you know, it's not just about learning content. It's also about developing those, the kind of social, emotional intelligence and skills and capacities that are going to allow you to take that subject matter and apply it under conditions that will never be optimal, never be ideal. So being able to understand how to negotiate the vicissitudes of your life, the vicissitudes that happen on a playing field, and do so with grace and skill and an optimal outcome.
Again, if you want to read more about any of these projects, you can always go to the Contemplative Sciences Center webpage at csc.virginia.edu. Dr. David Germano here today from the center, executive director, professor of Buddhist studies. Professor, let's go down a few grades. You've also got something going called the Compassionate Schools Project, working with public elementary schools.
Yeah, the Compassionate Schools Project was really our first large project and continues to be the largest one we've done. And it's an interesting story there because it started off with Paul and Sonia Jones have an organization, our original donors, called Pure Edge. And the Pure Edge has been really focused on these issues of how to bring practices and ideas of flourishing into, you know, the K-12 system. And so we initially got into it in that way. And then we were thinking, this is something we'd like to make a big investment in because it's not like there's like all these kids that come to us at the age of 17 or 18, obviously they were all 5 and 6 year olds at one point. And the better K-12 educational experience they have, the better poised they're going to be to thrive and succeed in terms of the 4 years they spend with us as undergraduates. And So we struck a deal with the city of Louisville, and the connection here is that the Brown family, which is a prominent family in the Louisville, Kentucky, has a long-term relationship with the University of Virginia. We have the Brown Residential College, which was named after their generous philanthropy, and a number of members of the Brown family over time have gone to the university, and in particular, a very good friend of mine, Owsley Brown III, who I met and talked to, and we discussed our common interest in contemplation and flourishing. And I told him a bit about what we were trying to think about doing for elementary school education. And he said, you have got to do this in the city of Louisville, Kentucky, which is where he comes from. It's where his mother and much of his family is, although he now lives in San Francisco. So he introduced us to the mayor, to the school superintendent, and really in this extraordinarily generous and powerful way, basically brought the University of Virginia to a city in the middle of Kentucky. And so we created this program called the Compassionate Schools Project as an idea for creating a curriculum that we think of as a kind of health curriculum for the 21st century. And what the health curriculum does is it integrates four different strands. One strand is social-emotional learning, something that's become increasingly common over the last couple of decades. But how do we teach our young children to be socially, emotionally intelligent, teach them these skills right from the start of educational process? Number two, we're teaching them attentional skills, things like mindfulness and ways to focus their minds and to manage their attention in ways that are harmonizing with their own goals and well-being and so forth. So working with the mind, working with their attentional practices, working with their awareness. And then number three, we address the issue of the kind of limitations of traditional approaches to physical education. And so instead of those approaches, we focused on flexibility, postures, movements, the kids' greater awareness of their bodies and how those bodies relate to their diet and their emotions and so forth, and breathing and how breathing relates to their emotional state and so forth. So we integrated the body, the mind, and the social emotional life of these kids. And then finally, in a little bit more basic level, we integrated dietary education. And so we created a curriculum where these four were completely woven together. And Alexis Harris is the person at the who's based at the in Louisville who manages this work for us. Patrick Tolan is the person who took the lead in the research from the School of Education at UVA. And Tish Jennings is the person who worked with Alexis on the curriculum and also has worked with Patrick on the research, as Alexis has as well. And so with that core team and a lot of other people from Louisville and the University of Virginia involved, we built this very detailed curriculum and we implemented it in across the school system. It's the 24th or 23rd largest school system in the country. It's called the Jefferson County Public School System. And we implemented it across there, and we did a randomized control trial of extraordinary scale and rigor, one of the biggest studies ever done in North America on these kinds of subjects. And so we're just now in the last year of that, a little bit delayed because of the pandemic, and we'll be releasing results at the end of next year. But the thing I wanted to add to this for our local, you know, audience is that we have brought this now to the city of Charlottesville. So last year, working together with the Charlottesville school superintendent in her office, we basically implemented this at Johnson Elementary School. And our goal is hopefully to try to bring this in a more mainstreamed way into the Charlottesville and Albemarle school systems. We're also partnering with Jim Notaro, who is the head of the Children's Hospital here at the University of Virginia. And they've started a project which is called a Pediatric Clinical Integrated Network. And this is only the second pediatric clinical integrated network in the country. And the basic idea behind this, really simple in simple terms, is that they create a data platform that's used by all clinics in the area, all pediatric clinics. And the data platform is used so that they can give optimal resources and advice for those clinics, but also so they can take all the results of those clinics working with those children and see where do we have healthcare problems and what patterns are there, so we can begin to address them in terms of public health. So the partnership here is that Jim's stated goal is he would like to see Charlottesville become the healthiest place in this country to raise a child or for a child to grow up. And so what we're trying to accomplish with local philanthropists who are helping support this is to implement the Compassionate Schools Project here in the elementary school system, and then do a research study that draws upon the anonymized aggregate data coming out of that clinical integrated network, so we can say exactly what the health cost implications are for the curricular choices we make or we don't make. So that for people who maybe aren't motivated by having an elementary school environment that's better for our children in terms of social, emotional, and mindfulness, and kind of physical flexibility and adaptability and so forth, if maybe they don't really care about that, but we can show that, in fact, if we do this, it's going to save millions of dollars from school systems around the country because of the consequences for these kids' health. And the saved money, because of the lack of, or the diminishment of various kinds of behavioral, mental, and physical challenges that ensue. So we're really excited about bringing that to Charlottesville and what the future might look like for Compassionate Cities Project in Charlottesville.
Professor, you've mentioned getting the numbers so you can show the benefits. Have you received any, I'll use the phrase, negative feedback in implementing this or discussing it from others who find the work wasteful? I used this phrase at the start of the hour, Eastern based, so therefore religious, or anything like that?
Yeah, so we've had in the city of Louisville extraordinarily positive kind of feedback and reception. It's really been incredible. But I think part of that has been our team has been really careful and rigorous and deliberate about what we're doing, because I think it's completely inappropriate to take Buddhist or Hindu or Christian or any kind of religious traditions and bring them into our school system. That's not what we're doing. We're focused on very basic issues, which all of us who are parents know about, which is how do we help our kids work with their own attention from a very early age? Our attention is core to everything we do in life, in education, in social interactions, and so forth. So let's make it the topic of reflection. This is not an Asian issue. This is an issue that we can find in the very roots of Western civilization. But how do we bring it into elementary schools and our bodies? I think team sports are important. So is, you know, kind of standard athletic training and so forth. But also, how do we, I think flexibility, adaptability, breathing, helping our kids pay attention to their bodily sensations and connect those to their emotional lives. This is pretty important too. Anybody who's had a kid who's on a crying jag or just can't regulate their emotions and so forth knows exactly what I'm talking about. And so these are very basic things rooted not in some distant, far off, you know, religious tradition, but really rooted in the literature that has developed over the last number of decades about how kids develop and what they need at different developmental phases. And social emotional stuff has been around for years now, but it's got to be experiential and it's got to be interwoven with their attention and their minds and their bodies as well. And so we see this as really something that's rooted in the best of what of all the world's cultures and contemporary academic, you know, research has to offer. And so we've been lucky to have a really positive reception in Louisville, but you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think part of it is that we have been very careful to do things that make sense for our culture and our time and our place, and is rooted in the best possible evidence that comes out of the research on these topics.
That's great to know. So we have less than a minute left. You mentioned Charlottesville City Schools and Superintendent Rosa Atkins. What time frame do you think that we might be bringing the Compassionate Schools Project into work here?
Well, last year was the first year, which was quite successful. This is the second year now that we're doing it. We're still doing it at Johnson Elementary, but we're diversifying it and so forth and expanding it a bit. The pandemic, of course, has made it very difficult. So the timetable is unclear right now. So it's going to, of course, depend upon what the superintendent is comfortable with and what makes sense for the schools. But it's also going to depend upon how much we can mobilize the local philanthropic community. The project in Louisville was really made possible because of extraordinary generosity by private individuals like Owsley Brown, his mother, Christy Brown, his family, Augusta Brown, and others, but also because of local foundations that made this a priority, the kind of innovation in local school systems. So hopefully we can mobilize the same kind of partnerships here at in Charlottesville, and together with the school district and the local community, you know, create the environment that we all aspire to for our children.
Okay. Dr. David Germano, Executive Director at the Contemplative Science Center, with us today. Doctor, thank you so much for being here with us. It was a great hour.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rick. It was really wonderful to talk with you today, and I appreciate the chance to share these things.
All right. Everybody have a great Sunday. Be with us again next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.